This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben. You are listening to episode 105 of my podcast, A Small Voice Conversation with Photographers. You know what podcast you're listening to, I don't know why I say that really. This week you're getting not one but two fantastic photographers for the price of one. The price as usual being, oh yeah, nothing, zip, zilch, nada, nout. It's gratis, kids. So it's fantastic to welcome as my guests this week Rebecca Norris-Webb and Alex Webb. Creative partners and collaborators, husband and wife. I will introduce them in a minute. What I'll do is read a few sponsor messages as usual, but I will break them up with some talking because there's stuff to tell you about, so don't skip forward. Have you joined Finder.me yet? If not, why not? Don't you want to get more jobs? Listen, Finder.me, Findr.me, is a two-sided marketplace for imaging professionals, providing clients with direct access to thousands of experienced photographers on a single platform, and in turn introducing photographers to hundreds of potential clients. Finder connects photographers with relevant customers based on location and type of photography services offered. Photographers can sign up quickly and easily and for free for corporate contracts at fixed rates, or they can set their own pricing to attract direct clients. And in stark contrast to some of their larger competitors, the good people at Finder, they care about you as a photographer and they are committed to total transparency in the way that they do business. Finder is basically for everyone in the photography business, from wedding planners to artists. And if you are a photographer, regardless of whatever type of photographer you are, go and open an account, start filling out your profile, open up a whole new way of finding new work, finding new clients and finding new opportunities. Join up for free at finder.me and get yourself found. If I sound different this week, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that it's 6:45 in the morning and I'm slightly hungover. Two, as a result of those factors, I am recording this intro from my bed. There's a first time for everything. I was getting up, but then I went to the kitchen to discover that I've run out of tea. How can you run out of tea? Who runs out of tea? Last night, I went to an opening at the ever-wonderful Trolley Books of Benedict Curzon and Sanna de Wilde. I think it's Sanna de Wilde, maybe, or de Wilde. Anyway, I don't know how to pronounce Sanna's surname. I apologise for that. But went to an exhibition of their collaborative project, Land of Abiji, about the mythology of twinhood in Nigeria, which just won the first prize for Portrait Stories in the World Press Awards. Google that if you haven't seen it. Interesting project. Lovely to meet those two and bump into a few old friends of the podcast. Thanks to Hannah at Trolley for organising a characteristically fab bash. Always good. The other launch, which I would have gone to if I'd figured out how to be in two places at once, is a new book by Maya Daniels, previously of this parish. Elf Dahlia is the book. It's published by Mac. It's the project she'd started working on when she did the podcast back on episode 13, so lovely to see that come to fruition. This episode of the podcast is also brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club, the first and only Book of the Month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist, along with a note card and a print from an esteemed guest curator, with free shipping to the US, Canada and the UK. All that, along with members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more, makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. May's Book of the Month, really looking forward to receiving, is Black Garden by the brilliant Jason Eskenazi, who one of these days I'd love to get on the podcast. Next time I get over to New York, Jason will be on the wish list for sure, along with numerous other people. What else? It's Photo London this week, which means it's also Peckham 24. It's a kind of alternative satellite event designed to coincide. So the madness begins tonight and tomorrow. I'll be down there recording nonsense for the annual Small Voice special, which, barring some kind of disaster, will go out on the next episode in 2 weeks' time. Hope to see a bunch of friends and former Small Voice guests down there. There are a number of people here who I did try my best to get hold of for a chat, but nothing has quite come together. Stephen Shaw is here, as is Mitch Epstein. Would have loved to get them on, but their schedules are full. Antoine Dagatar was due to be here, but I understand he had to cancel his trip, so no Antoine either, but hopefully I will grab him another time. We'll see what else happens. This episode of the podcast also sponsored by PicDrop. I tend to think of PicDrop as basically WeTransfer on steroids. PicDrop is an image transfer tool aimed at professional photographers. Founded by a professional photographer, it's the easiest and fastest way to send photos to your clients, collaborate on edits, and much more. With PicDrop, you can do so much more than just send files to your customers. Instead, you're sending them an interactive gallery where they can rate, comment, and select and download full resolution files, easily upload your images, and let PicDrop do the rest. Also, like many web-based services of its type, PicDrop operates on a freemium model, so it is totally free for the basic plan, and that may be the only plan you ever need. So you've got nothing to lose at all by trying it out. What's more, if you sign up at PicDrop.com, that's PicDrop.com, you'll not only get a month's free trial with all the features enabled, but use the coupon code ASMALLVOICE, and you'll also get an extra 2 months of PicDrop Premium on top of that. So try it out. It is a really cool service, and I can see it being useful for a lot of you. Click the link in the show notes on the website or go to picdrop.com. Don't forget, if you are a regular listener, you think this podcast is worth about a fiver a month, that's one cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription. Or if you prefer, as some of you do, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/asmallvoice. Someone pointed out that you do get a receipt, so you can claim it. Do please leave a positive review on iTunes so that others may find out about it. And if you should need a new website, let me do that for you on the Squarespace platform so that you do not have to waste your valuable time and energy figuring out how to do it yourself. So finally, let us get to the main event. I don't think either Rebecca Norris-Webb or Alex Webb need much introduction, frankly. Rebecca was originally a journalist and a poet before falling in love with photography and transitioning to a career that has since incorporated all of those disciplines in numerous books and exhibitions. Alex Webb is famous for his vibrant, complex colour street photography, especially that from Haiti, Cuba and Mexico, though he has more recently begun shooting on home soil in the US. Together, as well as being husband and wife, they have shared a long creative partnership, collaborating on numerous book projects, including Violet Isle, their work from Cuba, Memory City and Slant Rhymes, among others. Their latest collaboration, Brooklyn, the City Within, is a book project about Brooklyn, which has been their home for many years, and that will be published by Aperture in September this year. By the way, a quick note of apology. I screwed something up. In my nervousness and ineptitude, I neglected to turn Rebecca and Alex's microphone on at the beginning of our chat. I knew something wasn't right, but my brain, I think, just went into neutral. So, because only my mic was working at the beginning, the sound quality is a bit rubbish for the first 1.5 minutes, at which point my brain came back online and I flicked the appropriate switch. So apologies for that, but aside from it, please enjoy this chat with Rebecca Norris-Webb and Alex Webb. Meanwhile, I shall go and buy some tea. It's lovely to have you both. I mean, I thought we'd sort of obviously focus on the stuff you've done together, seeing as you're both here. Although, there's so much to talk to you about individually as well. When did you guys meet then? Let's get the backstory on your relationship.
Shall I start?
Why not?
Okay. So we met in the late 80s, and we were friends for 7 years. Before we actually started dating.
Right. So it's kind of a slow burn thing then, really.
Yes. I mean, we were both involved with other people at the time.
Oh, I see.
We became very good friends. And then decided to get together.
Rebecca, you transitioned, well, you were a poet, as I think a lot of people will know, or you still are, I would say. But how did that transition to photography happen for you? I mean, did you already know Alex at that point, or did it happen before you'd even met?
Oh, it had happened before we met. The story was, I studied poetry at the university, and after my studies, I found that for some reason my poetry had deserted me. So since it was the 70s, I decided to take a road trip for a year and bought a small point-and-shoot camera, hoping at the end of that year my photographs would spark my poetry. But instead, at the end of that year, I fell in love with photography.
Right, okay.
And I began to see that, you know, the same eye that saw the images in my poetry was the same eye behind the lens.
Mm. But like, so let's talk a little bit about, I guess, how your poetry has influenced your photography, and then maybe the, you know, some of the kind of similarities between those two forms. Do you think there are similarities?
Yes. I mean, I really think that both poetry and photography are sister arts. You know, they share some of the same preoccupations, you know, with the moment, with trying to sort of figure out life and death in the world.
Mm. And there's a kind of distillation involved, isn't there, in both?
Yes.
I would say.
Yes.
Kind of like an image is a very distilled thing, and I guess poetry is the sort of distillation of language in a way. So, like, when you first started collaborating, was it the Cuba book? Was that your first collaboration together?
Yeah, Cuba, the book Violet Isle, was our first collaboration. You know, it was not ever conceived of initially as a collaboration.
Right.
We both were working on individual projects in Cuba. I was photographing in the streets of Cuba, very much in the spirit of much of my work, sort of allowing the sort of the world of the street to flow by my camera, and sort of allowing my experiences with the camera to lead me where they will. And I was tentatively going to call my project Esperando, because Esperando in Spanish means both hoping and waiting. And there seemed to be kind of a palpable sense of hoping and waiting in the streets of Cuba. And it seemed almost larger than the obvious things, you know, the end of the U.S. embargo or the death of Fidel. There almost seemed to be a metaphysical sense of waiting. And Rebecca, who discovered all these quirky collections of animals all over the island in zoos and aquariums and personal menageries, she was going to call her project
Three Rooms, because I met this lovely man in Havana who raises cockatiels and pigeons and lovebirds. And he says to me, I have three rooms in my house. Two are for my birds and one is for my wife and me.
Right.
And after about 15 years of working on these individual projects, just before our 10th and penultimate trip to Cuba, we suddenly hit on the notion of bringing the work together. And I'm not sure exactly why we did this. It may have been a reaction to how many different photographers wanted to do books on Cuba and we wanted to do something really different. But anyway, it was an experiment. But as we began to interweave our photographs, we began to realize that our photographs were talking to one another in interesting ways and creating other kinds of meanings. And we realized it was beginning to create a sort of more multi-layered portrait of the island than either of our individual bodies of work would. And so that's how it came about. Mm. But I think that it probably wouldn't have come about successfully if it hadn't happened totally organically without our ever trying to push it.
Mm-hmm. But was it a bit of a kind of aha moment that you suddenly realized that you stumbled upon something, you know, that might actually continue on?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it was a real revelation for us, a big surprise, because certainly in our earlier years in photography, yes, we had started, you know, consulting one another when we were editing our respective bodies of work and listened to each other, but we were really very wary of the notion of trying to do a project together. We thought that could be problematic for the marriage.
Really?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's a complicated thing.
Yeah, of course.
But this really opened up the possibility for future collaborations, which have taken on sort of different forms in each instance.
Actually, I was going to ask you. You know, you do sometimes help each other with your respective individual projects, you know, when it comes to the editing and all that kind of thing. I guess you've always done that, have you?
Well, I think it's been maybe 20 years that we've done that. And that also happened kind of organically. I think we both realized that we were each other's biggest fans. But because we were that, we also were very insightful critics. And it was a sense that it would be better if each other told us what we thought were the weaknesses of a project before the project went out into the world. And so even though that caused sometimes some tensions in the marriage, we realized that overall it was worth going through that creatively. But there was one key component, and perhaps a marriage-saving component, which was the artist always had the final say.
Right. Yeah, that's a very sensible kind of policy, I think.
Right, but that's a little more complicated when it's a collaborative work, because we had to work that out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it was going to be, you know, an important question to sort of, you know, bring up the whole issue of, you know, having to have a marriage and keep that on the rails, but also to work together. And that, you know, then that's going to bring up its own tensions, I would imagine, because it is difficult to collaborate, you know, and keep things, you know, on a kind of even keel in a way. What other sort of respective strengths and weaknesses that you both kind of feel that you bring to the collaboration? Like, I mean, I guess, like, Alex, what do you see as your weaknesses that maybe, you know, Rebecca can kind of compensate for? And then I'll ask Rebecca the same question, because I want to ask you what your...
Well, maybe it's better even to talk about what I see as Rebecca's strengths, you know, I think that, you know, Rebecca has a kind of subtle way of sort of discovering the metaphors that sort of inhabit a project. And I think that she did that, you know, initially very successfully with the Cuba work, where somehow she discovered that somehow all these birds flying seemed to suggest something or another interesting about an island in which, when we were there, basically almost no one was allowed to travel outside of Cuba. So here are all these birds, often in cages. And that sort of resonated in interesting ways off of my pictures in the streets.
Right.
You know, I would say with Memory City, she discovered this notion of young women and their dresses as being kind of a metaphor for the notion of film, for the slip of film that, you know, is only used in an important event, the same way a certain kind of dress, a christening dress, a wedding dress is used. Mm. And so that was her way of getting at a metaphor for, you know, film, and of course in Rochester with Kodak and the potential disappearance of film with Kodak's bankruptcy and so forth. And again, I think that resonated off of what I was doing in Rochester.
Yeah. So this was the later project, which was, as you say, Memory City, about Rochester and the demise of Kodak and all that stuff. And do you remember, Rebecca, the moment when the dresses thing kind of came up, or do you remember how that sort of evolved in your mind as an idea?
I think I was looking at Rochester from lots of different angles. And one of the things I was very curious about was that Susan B. Anthony, a known woman suffragette, was from Rochester. And like my family, she also was a Quaker. And I got very interested not only in sort of her and that legacy, but also all of the women that history tends to overlook in a city. And so I wanted women to play a role, a very important role in that book.
Mm. Memory, obviously, you know, its relationship with photography is very kind of integral and kind of unavoidable. Could you maybe talk a little bit about, you know, your feelings towards memory and photography and how those things tend to relate to each other in terms of, you know, maybe in terms of that particular project, if you like?
Well, another doorway into the Rochester project, Memory City, and is often the door into most of my projects, is poetry itself. And there's been several noted poets, American poets, that lived in Rochester, John Ashbery, Ilya Kaminsky, Marie Howe, to name just a few. And there was a line from Ilya Kaminsky that really struck a chord in me. And the line was, "Time, my twin, take my hand through the streets of your city. And there was something about that and about how that evokes memory, because Kaminsky himself had moved with his family from the Ukraine, that made me sort of think about and look at the sense of memory in this book, as well as the other sort of way of coming around it, is that we loved the title itself, which also evoked Calvino's Invisible Cities.
Mm. And for you, Alex, there was this whole other element of, you know, Kodak and your sort of lifelong use of Kodachrome, and you know, that was obviously, there was a kind of, I guess, an emotional element to it. And was there, I don't know if it's apocryphal, were you actually using the last few rolls of film? Is that actually what happened?
Well, to some extent, I mean, yeah. There are still a few rolls floating around the refrigerator, which will never see the light of day. But yeah, when we went up to Rochester, you know, Rebecca said, you know, maybe there's someone up there who can process Kodachrome. Maybe that would be interesting to see, you know, in terms of thinking about Rochester and its history as the home of Kodak and so forth. And we got up there and asked around, and no, there was no way that anyone had the very elaborate machinery to process Kodachrome as color. But there was a guy there who could process it as black and white. And we thought that was very interesting. And you know, Kodachrome is, you know, on some level, very similar to a black and white film, except that it has four layers in it. Mm. And the dyes are added in the process of developing. So, you know, I tried a few rolls, and it came out with this kind of rough, grainy, it was a sort of a fascinating quality. It reminded me of a cross between sort of slightly badly processed Tri-X and infrared. Yeah. And so this seemed to me to be sort of appropriate and evocative. So when I was in Rochester, I photographed in color digitally, but for much of the time I also carried another camera with Kodachrome and took it and shot it as black and white, as sort of my way of, you know, paying homage to all those years of using Kodachrome.
Mm. So it was sort of a project which in the end had about five different things going on all at once. You managed to kind of combine all these different layers, which I suppose is partly the aim, you know, in a way.
Well, you know, what was interesting about the book is that we basically photographed for a year. We made five trips, and it took us a year to come up with the sequence, because trying to, you know, interweave, you know, Rebecca's pictures from around Rochester generally, mine from around generally, and Rebecca's actually in color neg, mine in digital color, then her pictures of the young women and their dresses, and then my Kodachrome black and white. How to make that work as a sequence was very, very tricky.
Mm. And I mean, do you sort of elicit opinions from other people who you know and respect, or is it very much a kind of just the two of you kind of, you know, hammering it out?
Well, with this book, this was maybe our third collaboration with David Chicky at Radius Books. And what's happened in working with David Chicky, the very talented and brilliant designer, is that we show him a project earlier and earlier in the process. And we weren't really sure what we were doing. And David got very excited at seeing it at those stages. And so he very much helped us work out how to incorporate all these different layers. And one of the things when I look at that book now, and in fact Alex now is working in a lot of American cities, other American cities, is that the book itself is sort of evokes all those sorts of layers that are in cities themselves. And I think we're both fascinated with cities.
Mm. We're very careful about who and when we show work to. There are a few other photographers who we think understand us and aren't going to be guided by their prejudices about whatever it is, whether, you know, I mean, I feel sometimes I show certain photographers my work and they they like it because they think it's like their work, or they dislike it because they think it's like their work. I mean, I feel like there's this whole agenda that they bring to the table that doesn't have necessarily that much to do with my work. And so we're quite careful. So there are a select few, but, you know, one of the things about David Chicky from the very beginning, from when he, you know, when he, because he was the design, the first book we worked with him on was the Cuba book. He right away got the nature of each of our work. And that was very important.
So you've found exactly the right person in that particular instance, which I guess is, you know, I guess really something that's pretty special, because like you say, you know, if you don't find that right person, it was good to know that even at your stage, you know, those problems that I think a lot of people might associate with, you know, the earlier stages of a career are still there, you know, the idea of, you know, it's good to get other people's opinions, but then at the same time, there's a kind of, you know, there's a downside to it. I mean, you know, you spend a lot of your time mentoring younger photographers and running workshops and stuff, so you can really, you know, you know what it's like from both sides of the equation, as it were.
Well, I mean, I think that it's important to always entertain the possibility of doubt, because I think doubt drives one, and it's one of one's many partners in the process of creation. It's important.
So when it came to Slant Rhymes, you were basically trying to edit 30 years worth of work. So, you know, where does one begin with that kind of a task? Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, the process?
Yeah, this book had an interesting history. It started with the fact, it started with an online version. We got our first smartphones very late, only about 4 years ago. And when we decided to do this, the first thing I got fascinated with was Instagram, because a good friend of ours and former student, Teju Cole, I really loved what he was doing with what he calls his captions, the text, and the images that he was putting on Instagram. And I thought, if we're going to do this, let's come up with just a loose project so that, you know, I really feel that social media can really preoccupy one. Why not have some kind of creative project to sort of play with on Instagram? So we started this. I would post one of my images, and then Alex would post one of his that he felt like worked as a slant rhyme, which in poetry is a rhyme that's not exact, like blue and moon, because we have two very linked, but they're very distinct visions. So sometimes it's a shared palette. Sometimes it's a shared geography. Sometimes it's a shared penchant for surprising or surreal moments. But anyway, about 4 months after doing this, La Fabrica came to us and said, you know, we'd really like to do a book of yours. Do you have any ideas? And we said, hey, why not this idea of slant rhymes? And they're like, great, could you get us something in a couple more months? And so a couple more months came by, and we looked at the work and looked at that work. And at that point, we were looking at all the work we had ever taken. And then we got back to them and said, I don't think we can do this. I mean, it's a very different animal working on social media versus a book. And then they said, take your time, go back, look at the work a little bit more. So we did, and what we realized, if we could limit it to only the 30 years that we've been together, we began to see that the way the work was speaking to one another sort of echoed our own relationship. And underneath it, the book itself felt like a kind of elliptical love poem. And that allowed us to sort of find our way into the book.
And, you know, pragmatically, you know, once we sort of realized it, then it was a matter of, you know, sort of each of us sort of mining our archives and making up lots and lots and lots of little, you know, 5x7-inch prints, and just starting to play with them and just seeing how the photographs talk to one another. I mean, I think that's really important for our process, this sort of tactile process of just putting some pictures down on the table and pulling this one out and saying, that's interesting. Does it work with that? No, not really, but look what it does with this picture. How interesting that those could possibly relate to one another. And so there are some, you know, slant rhymes in this book which are very obvious and evident, particularly some of the ones from Cuba where it's the same place and it's clearly the same shared Cuban palette. But, you know, there's a spread there where there's a picture of Rebecca's from South Dakota of these blackbirds flying over these sunflowers, and it's paired with a picture of mine from Cuba. And we never would have thought that these pictures could have talked to one another, but somehow they do in some interesting way.
Yeah. I can imagine it was a lot of fun to kind of make those discoveries, though.
Yes.
Well, actually, I think it's always sometimes nice to hear about individual images. So, Rebecca, that one on the cover with the pigeon, I presume it's a pigeon. Can you talk a little bit about that image and you know, your memories of taking it?
Yes. That image I took when I was working in Cuba on the Violet Isle project. And actually, it's an image that is near and dear to my heart because I took it the day that we knew Alex's dad was dying and we were trying to get back to Boston from Havana, and we couldn't get out that day, and we couldn't get out to the next day, so we didn't know what to do. So we decided, well, you know, we were both saddened, but we thought, well, let's just photograph. And when I went to this particular menagerie, this young man who was about 28, he said to me this amazing story. He said, I almost died and my birds brought me back to life. And that quote was resonating in my mind. And when I was kneeling on the floor taking that picture, and when the egg was there and the bird flying away, it took me a few months, you know, and after my father-in-law, who I dearly loved, died, I realized how much that was evocative of life and death and at that very moment.
Yeah. It's got a resonance there when you hear the story. That's good. I'm glad I picked that one. Because, yeah, I didn't know all that stuff. So that's really interesting. Alex, I wanted to... we're kind of jumping around a bit here, but I think that's fine. I don't think it really matters. I wanted to pick you up on a quote of yours, Alex.
Well, something I said that will haunt me forever.
No, it's really interesting. But I just wanted you to sort of expand on it. Really,
okay.
You were talking about the sort of photographs that intrigue you and that you know remain difficult to you know as difficult to get as ever. And you saying perhaps because the line between facile photographic cleverness and significant insight is so delicate and unpredictable. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what you meant by that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I find really intriguing about photography and what makes it so frustrating as well as occasionally rewarding is that it's really hard to, you know, when you're out photographing, to figure out when a photograph works. And then even when you look at it later on, you know, what do I really think of this? Is this successful? Does it do something? Does it take me somewhere special? You know, I often find that it takes me a little time to digest a photograph and understand. There are occasional photographs that I take that I know right away, oh yeah, this is very special. But there are others that sort of creep up on you. And because I take pictures that are often quite complex, and there's, you know, there is sometimes an element of sort of, you know, this possibility of juggling all these different kinds of things together in a single frame, you know, sometimes I'll look at a picture and say, well, it's really great that I got all that together, but maybe it's just clever. Maybe it's not something that goes beyond that, that's evocative. And sometimes I have to live with a picture like that and think about it and maybe ultimately reject it.
Yeah, that's great. And that's really, I think, a really useful thing to hear. Now, you did also a book which was kind of like a how-to book, or not.
Or not, I would say. Yeah. Or it's been billed as a how-to book, yeah. But it's not.
No, exactly, it's not.
It's a book about the creative process, is what it really is.
Yeah, and that's I think that's fascinating in itself. And it's kind of similarly the way that Slant Rhymes came out of the Instagram thing. This came out of your blog, did it not? How did that happen, Rebecca?
Yeah, this came out of a blog we started probably after teaching for 10 years. What we realized is that students were having a similar experience in our workshops, but they were having them all over the world. And we thought, why don't we create a blog that could bring together all these former students online? And we called it Two Looks. And we talked about our own photographs. We talked about other people's photographs, including those people who had influenced or inspired us. We sometimes talked about literature. And Aperture came to us and said, we'd like you both just to be, you know, to help start this, what they called the workshop series. And they again, they needed it relatively quickly. And I said, you know, I think we can do this, Alex, because we've written about a lot of these topics online. And so we used our blog as the sort of the main material. And then we created a shape for the book from that.
Mm. What was that process like for you, Alex, that making that book?
Well, I think one of the things that it did, you know, I mean, one of the things about teaching workshops is it sort of forces oneself as a photographer to try and occasionally make verbal stabs at explaining something that is probably ultimately inexplicable in words.
Yeah.
Because photography is a visual language, and its great power and strength is that it's a visual language, and it can't be said in words. If you could say it in words, why not just write an essay?
Mm.
But this book, even more than that, forced me to do that. I found it really interesting and thought-provoking to sometimes look back at certain pictures or think about, you know, the certain notions that lay behind certain things that I was doing that I wasn't trying to express verbally, but this forced me to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of funny because, you know, I'm doing an audio podcast about photography. There's kind of an inherent gap. There's a joke in there, right? You know,
right.
I hope that people realize there's kind of a joke to it, but it does seem to work. But, you know, it's like, I think, what was it, Brian Eno said, like, you know, writing about music is like dancing about architecture.
Right.
And I sometimes feel like, you know, talking about photography is a bit like dancing about architecture as well. But here we are, doing our best anyway. So, well, let's talk about the Brooklyn project, which is your kind of new project. Tell me a little bit about how this came about, because I guess, you know, you live in Brooklyn, right?
We live in Brooklyn, but we are in the process of slowly, and we don't know exactly how long or slow this process will be. We're in the process of extricating ourselves from Brooklyn.
I know.
You know, we ultimately want to end up in a place that is, you know, less urban at the end of our lives. And so when we started thinking about this, we realized that, hey, maybe the best way to do something with this creatively would be to do a book on a Brooklyn together. And, you know, I mean, neither of us have, you know, tended in the last, you know, 20 or even more years to do things specifically on where we live. So this was a somewhat different kind of challenge, and an interesting challenge, and a very exciting challenge.
Mm. So is it almost like a farewell to the place in a way?
On some level it is, but we don't know when the actual act of, you know, this may drag on for a while. We do love Brooklyn, but we do also, I mean, we have this place on Cape Cod, which we bought from my brother and sister, which was my family's place on Cape Cod. And we find that it's the place where we best lay out books, where we can best edit. There's something or another about this kind of retreat. My mother was a sculptor, and so we have her old sculpture studio. So, you know, at the moment on the walls of the studio, there are layouts of four different books, both individual and collaborative projects, and we come back to them every once in a while, and we live with them in a way that would be impossible in our little apartment in Brooklyn. And and, you know, the sequence isn't working in a project. So, well, you go for a walk on the beach and you come back and all of a sudden something seems to make sense. I mean, it's just a different kind of creative process than we have in Brooklyn.
I mean, I was wondering about what the challenges are of kind of trying to produce work from your on your own doorstep, as it were. Is, you know, mm-hmm. is that difficult? What are those challenges? You know, is it about trying to get past the familiarity of everything? Because I think, you know, when you do go to some exotic locale, you see pictures, or at least I think you see pictures everywhere, and which you don't really do on your own doorstep. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a challenge. On the other hand, I have to say that my process of photographing in Brooklyn was very, very much of an exploration because, you know, Brooklyn is a huge and varied, you know, borough. It's a place of 2.7 million people. If it was a city by itself, it'd be the fourth largest city in the United States. So there are loads and loads of parts of Brooklyn that I didn't really know. So, you know, in some ways, photographing Brooklyn, I found myself doing something that in certain ways paralleled what I did for many years, in that I was photographing a multitude of different cultures. But instead of using an airplane, I was just using the subway, because I was photographing, you know, Mexican Brooklyn, Caribbean Brooklyn, Chinese Brooklyn, you know, as well as other things in Brooklyn as well. But so there was this strong sense of exploration. I'd never been in Maplewood before. I'd never even heard of the neighborhood of Maplewood. Right. You know, I didn't really know Bushwick very well. Obviously, from a pragmatic stance, there are differences. I mean, you know, when I go off and photograph, you know, say in Mexico, I spend a certain amount of time there. I feel like it's me, the camera, and the world, and that's it. In Brooklyn, one's living one's life day to day. So, you know, it may be that, okay, this afternoon, I have an open afternoon, I can go out and photograph. Mm. And there's, in some ways, there's less pressure because I know that I'm staying there and I'm continuing to photograph versus, say, in Mexico, I've been there for 2 weeks. I know I've only got 2 weeks here. I got to do something. Mm. So it's that's different in terms of the rhythm.
Yeah. And, I mean, just to sort of clarify, this isn't stuff that you've gone out and shot specifically for this, but this is stuff that you may have shot over sort of
long periods. No, this came out of a decision 5 years ago that we are going to do something on Brooklyn.
Oh, cool.
Specifically.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the book and this construction of this book, you know, we call the project The City Within, Brooklyn, The City Within, because, of course, Brooklyn is a city inside the larger city of New York. But also, Rebecca has been photographing the green heart of Brooklyn, Prospect Park, the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens, Greenwood Cemetery. And so on some level, she's photographing the green heart of the city within the city within the city. And I've been photographing all around Brooklyn. So the structure of the book actually is that her pictures are in the middle of the book and mine are at the beginning and at the end. So in that sense, it's quite different than our other books where we've interwoven our respective bodies of work, because there's a geographic reason as to why it's constructed that way. Also, and it's a little hard to see in this dummy, but when you get to Rebecca's work, you'll see that it's bled. And the trim size is actually slightly different. So there's like a quarter of an inch cut off one edge. So it feels like her pictures are really a book within the book.
I see. Yeah.
So basically the book has three sections, my section, her section, and then back to my section.
Right, yeah. So we don't have to guess who's and all that, and you don't have to caption them thus.
But also, the other thing is that there are 9 text pieces of hers that run through her section. So it's a very, very different feel to it. There's much more a feel of sort of reverie in these green spaces in her work, whereas mine are more urban and hard edge.
Yeah, I love it. And you've made this dummy we're now looking at. I wish the listeners could see. Actually, they can see if they go to your Instagram account. There's a little video they can find there, and they'll see the very dummy that I'm looking at here. But tell me about, you know, the process of making these. You've gone for a pretty lo-fi approach, which is deliberate.
I both of us like the sort of tactile feel of a dummy. You know, I don't like working on a screen. I mean, I'm also not the greatest at InDesign either. So that is another issue. But I've always liked building dummies. I liked the process. There's something about the process of, you know, making these color Xeroxes of various different sizes, playing with them, seeing what works, taping them in, the act of taping them in. Somehow there's a kind of deliberation about it that seems, you know, important. And by doing that, it coalesces something for me in the process. It's harder than move it. So you got to make a decision. Are you going to put this in or put it not put it in? And we just find that the tangibility of a dummy is important in our process of understanding the nature of what the book can be. The dummy is not exactly to size. We allow, in this instance, David Chicky, the designer, to, you know, make we work on those decisions and so forth, but it's just give a sense of what it is that we're thinking about.
Mm. It's a bit like when you, you know, editing and you've got little work prints or something and you can maybe move them about on the wall rather than trying to do that on the computer screen. It's not the same.
Well, this is exactly what we do in our process. We, you know, we make, you know, we start building sequences. We build relationships between photographs. We leave them on the wall. You know, until there's a time comes when we think, okay, maybe it's now time to start making the color Xeroxes to build the dummy.
Mm.
And then at some point, I go off to Kinko's or some other copy store and make lots of color Xeroxes and then start cutting and pasting and taping and so forth.
I love it. Tell me a little bit about the words in here, Rebecca. You know, because you're obviously, you're sort of exercising your the other, you know, element of your talents in a way. Are these actual poems or are they just little bits of prose?
I would say that the seven of them are prose poems, which is a hybrid form. And then two of them are poems. Most of them came while I was walking in these green spaces. And so they're very much affected by a kind of a sense of reverie. I mean, I think the challenge for me in this project is that I was photographing and writing about these green spaces that I love, that I know like the back of my hand. And I wanted to try to come up with a form that would make sense, that would allow me to be able to say farewell to this borough, which also was the place where I credit as my creative home, because it's where I took my first important photograph for The Glass Between Us, my first monograph. What I found in this process is that it really returned me to my roots as a street photographer. When I first moved to New York City 30 years ago and took my first photography classes at ICP, the work that really spoke to me, I was very shy, I was a poet before I was a photographer, and the work that spoke to me was that of Helen Levitt and her work especially of children on the Lower East Side. And so I found myself often in these green spaces photographing children, sometimes photographing creatures. And I also, often while walking, the first line of some of these prose poems came to me. In fact, maybe it would be good if I just read one of the short pieces. Is that possible?
Yeah, no, please do. That would be great, yeah. Please
just to give a sense.
I think that's a great idea.
I like the idea in this of the way that the images and the words work together. They're kind of meeting places where landscape and memory and history and reverie meet. I got very fascinated at the fact that Prospect Park, which was also designed by Olmsted, who designed Central Park, he was given this commission, and it was the site of a Revolutionary War battle that the Americans lost. And so he had the role of trying to create a monument to this lost battle. So this is where this prose poem begins. It's called Battle Pass, Prospect Park. Thank you, Frederick Law Olmsted, for creating a memorial to a lost battle in the shape of a park, for inviting us to walk across our losses like water, more a matter of buoyancy than miracle, for doesn't loss help hold us up like those dead soldiers beneath our feet? And lastly, thank you for Longmeadow, your prize. It is part daydream, part grassland,
designed to seem borderless, for aren't the dead here with us, like one great green undulating we.
That's lovely. Thank you so much for doing that. Yeah, so it would be great to get a few tips on bookmaking in general. I mean, Alex, you've done so many. And I'm sure the kind of people who you mentor and who you do workshops with want to, you know, hear about. I guess from my point of view, I'm thinking, you know, what are the pitfalls, or what are the most common pitfalls that you see on a kind of fairly regular basis that people perhaps could avoid falling into?
Well, don't do the first book too soon.
Right.
You know, because I think one only has so many chances to do a book.
Mm-hmm.
The first one will probably be the most difficult. It'll probably be the most exciting, the most emotionally rewarding, but the most painful too. And the pragmatic process of getting out there will almost certainly be the most painful. But so make sure you feel really good about it when you try and bring it out.
Right. So sort of trust your gut in a way, if you know, your instinct is to...
Well, I mean, I believe strongly in believing in, you know, in trusting one's instincts and all this, because, you know, it's, you know, photographing and making books, it's not about the head, or it's one part of the brain, not another part, you know, but it's about the heart and it's about the stomach as well.
Mm. Yeah. It's funny, I chatted with Martin Parr recently, your Magnum colleague, and he made the point that people are lazy. He wasn't being horrible. He was just being honest, you know, that the youngsters that he sees are just not putting in the graft. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's something to that as well?
Look, I mean, I think that there are some less successful books out there that could definitely have withstood a bit more time and a bit more effort. But there are also some very interesting things that are coming out. I mean, I think, you know, what I find particularly interesting about the whole photography bookmaking process is that, you know, when I emerged as a photographer, when I first started thinking about doing a book in the mid-80s, there was still a semblance of a photographic book publishing industry. I mean, it was difficult to find a publisher, but there were publishers out there who did try to publish books the sort of traditional way. You know, a photographer comes in with a bunch of prints or a dummy, and the you know, publisher decides it's for whatever crazy reason that, well, we can make a book out of this, and we'll pay for it, and maybe we'll make back our money, you know. Needless to say, most of those books didn't make back their money. But that has really largely disappeared. There's only a handful of books of photographic book publishers that do that. Now, you know, most photography books are brought out with some kind of subvention of some sort, whether it's, you know, a museum or a gallery funding it, or a grant, or someone using Kickstarter, or borrowing money from their parents, or robbing a bank, or whatever crazy reason. But what's interesting is that there are many more photographic books being published now than ever before. And some part of me thinks that maybe this is almost a reaction against the internet, that somehow there's this need for photographers to have these tactile objects, because somehow it just isn't the same viewing something on a screen.
Mm. No, I mean, I agree with you entirely there. I think that's true. I've made that point. You know, I'm like, I love my Kindle, you know, because I don't, you know, I don't have to have hundreds and hundreds of paperback novels knocking around anymore that I've got to put in boxes every time I move flats. But, you know, that's no good with a photo book. You've got to have the actual thing. And I think you're right, you know, it is a reaction to the kind of digital world, the screen world that we all live in. So it seems like it's actually a great time for photo books. Rebecca, what if you hadn't transitioned to photography, what do you think you would have ended up doing? Do you think you could have, you know, can one even make a career out of poetry? I would have imagined that's even harder than bloody doing it with photography.
I've always been interested in filmmaking, you know, so if I hadn't gone into photography, I think I might have gone into filmmaking as well. But at the same time, Alex actually was just working on a set of Sally Potter's, and I think we were both reminded at how many people are involved, how complicated films are, how much time you spend raising money for films. So, you know, even though that's kind of a pipe dream, you know, I don't know. I don't think that I do think that I feel like that I never saw myself just a poet in a room. There's something about photography that means that I go out into the world exploring, and I really like that part, that aspect of it. And I guess that's why filmmaking also is something that I've been intrigued with.
What about you, Alex? I think you had, didn't you have sort of literary aspirations? Or you certainly had an interest in writing.
Yeah, I mean, I did. You know, I did try to write a novel when I was in college, which was an utter disaster.
Well, at least you tried.
At least I tried. Yeah, I think some of the same of what as what Rebecca just said, which is that, well, for me, I actually felt at a certain point that I didn't know enough to write a novel. That I felt that, you know, if you read War and Peace, man, you know, I mean, I feel like, wow, Tolstoy really knew a lot about life, really a lot, you know. And I felt like I still don't know. I certainly still feel I don't know anywhere near that much about life. But so there was something about going out into the world with the camera and responding that somehow this was a way that I could do something that somehow made sense for me. Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, you know. You know, there are times when I, you know, think of, you know, what it would be to be a writer or a painter, and you're sitting in a room and you're looking at a blank sheet of paper or a blank computer screen or at a blank canvas. And part of me, you know, sort of envies that idea of just sitting in that room and doing it. But then when I really think about the notion of dealing with that blank paper or that blank canvas, I go, I'm not sure I can do this. I need the world. I need the partnership with the world. I need to, and also the physicality of just walking. I mean, for me, the process of walking is really important. I mean, I get into this sort of slightly daydreamy state where I don't know quite what I'm thinking about, but I'm at the same time incredibly alert to whatever it is that's going on around me. And when it works, I feel like, well, This is you know, one of the few things I was actually made to do in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you found that thing. I mean, you know, I guess a lot of people don't even come close to it, but it does get you into the world. It's not, as you say, you're not sitting in front of a blinking cursor, which must be, you know, pretty tough thing to have to do at times. What about tips on collaboration for people who might think they want to explore, you know, a collaboration with another photographer or another, you know, creative of some sort? Any kind of, you know, do's and don'ts that you have gleaned from your own collaboration over the years?
Well, I think has been probably pretty evident in listening to us, you know, there's a very specific and deep relationship to us, and the collaboration is essentially tied to that. So, you know, I mean, I think that if you're collaborating with someone, there should be some kind of reason for you to collaborate, not because, you know, oh, well, you know, we kind of like to try something together. You know, I'm not saying it has to be the kind of intense emotional bond that we have, but I think there needs to be some kind of reason.
You also need to allow for the unknown to happen in that collaboration. You're going to have two visions coming together, and there are always going to be gaps. And I think the more and more that we've collaborated, we've started to respect those gaps. I think the poet C.D. Wright said it best when she talked about her collaboration with the photographer Deborah Luster. She said, "Cracks are a given between one collaborator and another. That's how the light gets in."
I like that. That's great. So when is the Brooklyn book going to, you know, actually come about? Is it
September?
Okay, September this year. Fantastic. So we shall look forward to that. And you know, what else is on the cards for either, you know, you as a collaborating pair or individually? Because I imagine you've always got, you know, kind of projects mm-hmm. on the back burner. Rebecca?
Yes, indeed. We decided that that's one of the secrets to a healthy marriage, which is having a collaboration, but we each have our own projects as well. We find that balance works the best. I've been working for 5 years on a project in a rural Indiana county where both my now 98-year-old country doctor father and I were born. I've been retracing the route of some of his house calls through the cornfields and floodplain of Rush County, Indiana. And I've been echoing his work rhythm. So I photograph predominantly at night and in the early morning when most people come into the world. He delivered some 1,000 people, and most people leave it. I'm calling it night calls. Again, there will also be text. I'm working from his memories, my memories, and the memories of some of the more than 7,000 patients he had in this rural and actually very conservative area of America. It's been really fascinating to look at landscape, and I've been working very deeply because this is a landscape that has its own dark shadows across it, including I come from Quaker stock, and so that farmhouse where my father grew up was used as a station on the Underground Railroad, and then a century later, a couple counties away from the county where I grew up was where the Ku Klux Klan began, and it's still an incredibly conservative county in which one of the only things I have in common with the people that I'm photographing is my father and their memories of him. I've been working with him, so this is very much a collaboration with him.
Wow, yeah, that's fascinating. And what about you, Alex? What are you up to?
You know, after about 35 years of photographing outside of the United States, when, you know, in 75 I made this decision going to the U.S.-Mexico border and Haiti, all of a sudden I realized I didn't want to photograph the United States itself, and that had to do with a complicated set of alienated feelings about my own country and what I was trying to do photographically that didn't seem to be working. And so for 35 years I, you know, photographed extensively outside of the United States. And starting with the Rochester book, I've become more and more interested in trying to return to my own culture. And, of course, Brooklyn is an extension of that. But what I've been doing now for the last 5 years is I've been photographing a number of different American cities. It started off actually with a trip to Indianapolis about the same time that Rebecca went to Indiana to start her project. And at that point, I thought, sort of as an extension of the Rochester work, maybe I'm going to do something on the Rust Belt of the United States. And I went to Cleveland. And then I happened to meet a Nigerian woman who lived in Houston, who told me that, you know, that Houston has the largest population of Nigerians anywhere outside of Nigeria, except perhaps London. And I thought, that's interesting. So I went to Houston. And that sort of opened up the project. I thought, you know, I'm not going to limit myself to, you know, just the Rust Belt. I'm going to look at a lot of American cities. And I still thought at that point I probably wouldn't include the largest and most prominent American cities, but I have since then photographed in Chicago. So I've now photographed in about a dozen different American cities. And I think part of it is really trying to sort of make some kind of sense of this strange and complicated country that I'm part of, and sort out all my feelings. I mean, I have very ambivalent feelings about a lot of things in the United States, particularly right now, but always have. But at the same time, I feel that I am very American. I haven't decided to go live in Canada or England or France or whatever. I feel like this is where I'm from, and there are aspects of the United States that I love, and there are aspects of it that I find are incredibly problematic and disturbing. So I don't really know exactly where the project's going. I just think that I'm sort of taking some pictures that I think are kind of interesting, and I'm going to keep doing it for a few more years and slowly build this thing and see where it ultimately leads to.
Mm. Well, it's interesting timing, isn't it, in terms of, you know, Trump and, you know, what's now happening. And I guess you might be maybe, you know, inadvertently documenting something that hopefully won't be lasting too long. Let's put it that way. You know, has that become part of the project in a
well,
way?
Well, I think it's there, but I did start under Obama. And I think, you know, the American cities are interesting because, you know, I mean, actually these days, most American cities, you know, in terms of the majority of people are anti-Trump. Most of the cities are blue, including places like Dallas and so
right.
forth.
It's really outside the big cities where Trump has his main yeah. base.
So on the other hand, the cities, you know, many of the cities are quite troubled. Some of them have, you know, severe racial problems, others less. So, you know, looking at the cities, you know, I'm seeing some things that I think are very good about the United States and also very problematic about the United States. But I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to take any kind of line on it. I'm really, you know, I feel strongly that whatever quote-unquote ideas come out of the work, and I feel this about my work in general, they have to emerge from the photographs, from the visual process, from my visual response that isn't, you know, tinged extensively by some kind of sociopolitical agenda, that it's a visual response and that whatever ideas come out of it will come out of the photographs themselves.
Right, yeah. It will be kind of organic in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I feel that's, you know, always true of my work. There are sociopolitical notions that certainly run through my work, but I feel that they're sociopolitical notions that are filtered through, you know, a particular way of seeing, a particular aesthetic, and a vision that's quite complex that isn't, you know, I mean, I'm not looking for answers when I'm photographing. I'm really just asking questions.
Right, yeah, yeah. Which is a strength of photography, or perhaps a weakness is that it's not very good at answering those questions.
Well, photography doesn't explain things. Yeah. You know, photography acknowledges things, but it doesn't explain things. Mm. You can let words do some explaining.
Yeah, well, I'm happy enough with that. Rebecca, what about, you know, whether there's going to be any, hopefully it will be more collaboration between the two of you as well as these kind of respective individual projects.
Yes, we haven't, well, I guess we're going to announce it next week, but Alex and I are really happy to have just learned that we have just been awarded one of the rarest birds in grants in the United States right now, which is an NEA grant, and it's for a collaborative project to photograph North Dakota. Which is the state just north of where I'm from, South Dakota. We got very fascinated with it because it's one of the most sparsely populated states, and at the same time, per capita, it's one of the most welcoming as far as refugees are. And I'm also very interested in returning to the Badlands. There's one of the reasons we even have a park system in this country is thanks to Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt first went to North Dakota, to the Badlands, when something very tragic happened to him. He lost both his wife and his mother on the very same day. And so he just left the East Coast behind and went to a ranch in the North Dakota Badlands. And there was something about those Badlands that spoke deeply to him. And when I was working on my second monograph, My Dakota, I found the same thing about the Badlands of South Dakota. So when I learned that story about Teddy Roosevelt, I've also always wanted to spend time in his ranch house and in the North Dakota Badlands.
Mm, right. Well, because when you did the South Dakota project, you were also grieving the loss of your brother, so there's a kind of parallel there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's very exciting. So, is it who gives that grant? The NEA, did you say?
National Endowment for the Arts, but it comes, you know, used to be that there were individual fellowships. I got one many years ago to do work in Mexico. Now they only come through institutions, then given to people through institutions. So ours is coming through the North Dakota Museum of Art.
Mm. Awesome. So, well, so much to look forward to then. That's a lot. And certainly the Brooklyn book, I guess, will be the next thing. Last time I spoke to you in London, you were about to publish Le Cahier.
Right.
And my main thought was, well, that's my Christmas present to myself sorted out right there. because, you know, I don't know about you, but I find as you get older, you the number of presents you get is in inverse proportion to numbers you have to give to smaller people. So I just buy myself a photo book now, and I'm totally happy with that. But, next Christmas is going to be the Brooklyn book, probably. Thank you both so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much.